Welcome, everybody. Today I'm going to talk about knowledge and how knowledge might follow rules of accommodation in the sense that I've described in the first two lectures. Just to remind you, in the first lecture I talked about how authority emerges from processes of accommodation and how that enables people to do certain authoritative things with their words that they might not otherwise be able to do. In the second lecture, I talked about how norms follow rules of accommodation, most obviously in the case where an authoritative speaker enacts a rule, but also much more informally via descriptive norms where utterance of a mere regularity can help enact a norm, perhaps a permissive norm or something stronger. I want today to talk about knowledge, which of course is not a move in a language game, far from it, but nevertheless there's something about knowledge that follows rules of accommodation, and I'll get to that in a moment. But first let me say something about knowledge more generally. As many of you know, I'm very interested in speech and normative issues about speech. And it will come as no surprise to anyone that knowledge has had a special role in connection with speech. And by that I mean, when we're thinking about the point of speech in general, when we're thinking about norms that might govern assertion in particular, and when we're thinking about the point of free speech. So, to give you some illustrations, I hope everyone has a handout. Does everyone have a handout? Well, if you don't have a handout, I don't know how to solve your problem, but I hope you have a handout, other than by hoping that my expression of my hope will help fix the problem. With regard to the point of free speech, J.S. Mill famously said that we must recognize the necessity to the mental well-being of mankind of freedom of opinion and freedom of the expression of opinion. This has been taken as a justification for a free speech principle. And then he lists four reasons, which I won't go into here. And he concludes that true opinion held as a prejudice is not the way in which truth ought to be held by a rational being. This is not knowing the truth. Truth thus held is one superstition the more, accidentally clinging to the words which enunciate a truth. I've argued elsewhere that this, although it's called the truth argument, is better named the knowledge argument. That little bit that I quoted suggests that what Mill is interested in is the role of freedom of speech in achieving a shared goal, namely the goal of knowledge. It's not just truth, it's not just an accidental truth, that's why he says prejudice is not good enough, even if it's a true prejudice. We need knowledge. With regard to speech generally, Robert Stalmacher has said that the point of speech, that why we do things with words, why we say things to each other, is to help each other to get to know things we didn't know before. And that's what he says is the point of speech generally. With regard to assertion, many people have argued that assertion should be viewed as a norm, not in the sense that Austin had of a felicity condition for speech. Obviously, you can assert things without knowing them. Obviously, you can assert things without even thinking you know them. If you believe something is false, you can still assert it, and that's a well-known speech act, which we might call a lie. Okay, so nevertheless, knowledge has been thought of as a norm for assertion in ways that I won't explore in detail here, but I do hope to return to them in the final lecture. You shouldn't assert something unless you know it. And there are different ways of unpacking that, perhaps more precise ways, perhaps ways that involve hearers as well as speakers. I'll just leave that aside. So knowledge has had an important role to play as a background norm for speech, for assertion, and for free speech. In all of these areas, the process of accommodation is involved. Accommodation is the routine process of adjustment whereby what we do with our words might require certain things to happen, and provided certain conditions are in place, hey presto, they just happen. Sometimes they happen thanks to the presence of felicity conditions that are provided by convention, by social institutions of marrying or naming ships, to take the famous Austinian examples. Sometimes the magic happens merely through the omission of hearers who allow them to happen. Someone says, even George could win, and nobody blocks by saying, what do you mean, even George? And the presupposition that George is an unpromising candidate gets added to what Lewis called the conversational score. So there, the omissions of the hearers, as I mentioned in the first lecture, are a vital contribution to the illocutionary force and to the accommodation of whatever the speech act needs to happen. Now, one could devote an entire series of lectures to simply the topic that I've mentioned under two in the handout, and that is the topic of how knowledge and its generation and its transmission involves these factors of accommodation. This happens when we assert something and somebody understands us. We tell somebody something, and I know that for Jen Hornsby, we should be thinking in terms of the speech act of telling, not the speech act of assertion. When we say something, when we tell someone something, they learn something. And that process itself involves accommodation. It involves an adjustment on the part of the hearer, which enables the speaker to do something. The adjustment on the part of the hearer is the kind of reciprocity, as Hornsby calls it. It's a kind of uptake, as Austin called it, which enables the hearer to do something with their words, namely say something, tell you something, assert something, and that's what testimony involves. Testimony involves the telling of something to someone else. So that's in the straightforward, explicit case. When I said you could have a whole lecture series just devoted to this, one of the most interesting sides to telling is sort of the backdoor ways we tell people things, the implicit ways we tell people things. So, even George could win, that tells the speaker, George could win, that tells the hearer, sorry, George could win, and it also tells the hearer that George is an unpromising candidate. By presupposing that George is an unpromising candidate. So there we have a backdoor speech act that works by presupposition introduction, facilitated by the omissions of hearers blocking them. And so much of what we tell each other comes through the back door. I'm amazed that we don't have a whole worked out theory of testimony that is not about assertion at all, but is entirely about these backdoor speech acts, which I'm calling them because I don't want to get into a debate about whether it's implicature or pragmatic presupposition or semantic presupposition or what it is. I'm just going to call them backdoor speech acts for short, which are not assertions, but which are one of the primary ways in which we tell each other things, or in which we communicate knowledge or purported knowledge. By the way, this even happens in fiction. Even when someone is telling a fiction, there is a backdrop of purported fact that they're telling the fiction against. So, Conan Doyle tells the Sherlock Holmes stories against the backdrop of London. London geography. Someone could learn real-world facts about London from the Sherlock Holmes stories because he's purporting that the London geography, I won't get too specific about Baker Street because I can't actually remember whether that's how fictional that is. But anyway, I believe there is a Baker Street, but I can't remember about the number. Anyway, There is purported facts in fiction, and that's something that Lewis also wrote about, and many others working in aesthetics and elsewhere have talked about. That's the topic of truth in fiction, and it's really purported knowledge in fiction. And that's important to politically significant speech. It's important to politically significant speech because a huge amount of what gets communicated through the back door is the backdrops to fiction. If you like, what fiction presupposes about the real world. One topic that I've written about together with Carolyn West is what pornography might presuppose, or what certain sorts of pornography might presuppose about the real world. It might presuppose that women who say no don't really mean no. Of course, it's true in the fiction that a particular woman who says no doesn't really mean no, but because of the way it's done, it only makes sense on the assumption that this is a regularity and that women who say no don't really mean it, even if it's in the context of a fiction. It's very important to take this seriously because many people say, how can you be so naive? How can you think that this is politically significant speech when it's entirely in the scope of a fiction operator? Don't you realize that somebody is making up a story here? Well, of course I realize that someone's making up a story here, but don't you be so naive as to suppose that stories do not have their own presuppositions about the real world. And that, I believe, is how many, many purported truths, how much purported knowledge about the world gets transmitted. You will remember that in the first lecture I talked about Nazi propaganda. Much of that was in the form of fiction. Der Giftpilz, the poisonous mushroom, the children's story, was entirely fiction, whose message was that the Jews living around you are to be feared. They are likely to kidnap children. They are the poisonous mushroom, terrifyingly indistinguishable from the healthy ones. So let's not be naive about what gets transmitted as purported knowledge in the ordinary way through backdoor testimony. So fiction can be backdoor testimony, presupposition can be backdoor testimony, and what I would like to suggest is that if we think that knowledge is a norm for speech, and if we think that knowledge is a norm for telling, for assertion, if we think that it's a norm of the sort of goal-oriented sort, as opposed to the deontic sort that might be there for assertion, if we think it's of the goal-oriented sort for free speech, then we should extend those norms to cover backdoor implicit speech acts. I'm going to argue for that in more detail in the final lecture, but I hope it's completely obvious that, contrary to what some people say, that knowledge is a norm for assertion and just assertion, no. You shouldn't say, even George could win, if you don't know George could win. And also, you shouldn't say, even George could win, unless you also know that George is an unpromising candidate. You should stand by what you assert, and you should stand by what you presuppose as well. This is really important when it comes to issues of taking responsibility for speech, which I hope to get to in the final lecture. Now, I said that there's a massive amount we could say on this topic, but what I mostly want to talk about today is something else. I don't want to talk about all the routine ways in which knowledge is involved straightforwardly in explicit or implicit testimony. I think it's hugely important. I've said enough, I hope, to say why I think it's important, but I want to get onto a different topic today, which is the question of how possibly knowledge itself follows a rule of accommodation, by which I mean not that it gets transmitted or ruined because it's only pseudo-knowledge that gets transmitted, but rather how factors that... Now, I hope that you'll help me in question time make the distinction that I feel is very clearly there, but I don't know how to label it. When I say knowledge itself follows rules of accommodation, what I have in mind is that knowledge can actually come and go in a way that follows rules of accommodation and not in a way that involves being sensitive to evidence and passing knowledge on in the via testimony. If someone can give me some helpful ways of thinking about the contrast I have in mind once you've heard what I'm going to say, I would really appreciate it, because I've been puzzling about how to label this distinction. It's not about, you know, evidential ways and non-evidential ways, but that's somewhere in the ballpark. So, the question, does knowledge follow rules of accommodation, might be weird. As I just said, you know, accommodation is about correct play. It's as if it's about whether you can perform a move in the game that is going to end up counting as correct play. And no one thinks of knowledge as a move in a game. Nevertheless, there's something about knowledge that I hope I can convince you does follow rules of accommodation, and the best way to do it is just to jump in and show you what I mean. I talked about authority in the first lecture, and I talked in particular about epistemic authority and practical authority. Practical authority in the first instance, role-based authority, epistemic authority in the first instance, expertise plus credibility. I mentioned, when thinking about practical authority, that there's this wonderful painting of, someone told me later that it's by David, and I should have remembered that, of Napoleon crowning himself. So there you have a literal self-coronation. And then what I talked about in the first lecture was other literal self-coronations in the sense of self-crownings of authority that don't involve an actual crown, but they do involve genuine authority. That's why it's not just metaphorical. Now, nobody's going to say that you can crown yourself with knowledge in the way that you can crown yourself with authority. You know, knowledge is about factors that are completely independent from you. Knowledge is about a mind-independent world. It's about, it's partly about a social world, but it's also about a non-social world. So nobody could think that you just get knowledge for free just by grabbing it. You're not going to just say, I am a knower, and thereby get to be a knower through the actions and omissions of others, in the way that you can say, I am the leader, and get to be a leader through the actions and omissions of others. So I'm not going to suggest something so implausible as that. Nevertheless, there are factors related to knowledge that follow rules of accommodation, and this involves both the loss of knowledge and the gain of knowledge. The loss of knowledge has been a very important topic in social epistemology. The gain of knowledge has been rather less so. The loss of knowledge has been discussed very importantly by, people like Miranda Fricker, Jose Medina, Kirsty Dotson. Many have looked at how authority, in the sense of epistemic authority, is very much dependent on antecedent background social factors. And what that means is that it can come and go depending on what's going on with those background social factors, informally, not just in the official case like Napoleon crowning himself. That's what I talked about in lecture one. But let me just spell out the implications for knowledge itself as opposed to credibility. In lecture one, I argued that credibility can follow a rule of accommodation, and that basically that's what Fricker and many others have been talking about. Speakers can alter the epistemic standing of agents. They can undermine credibility. This is a very familiar thought. One example from Fricker's book, Epistemic Injustice, is the example from The Talented Mr. Ripley, where Marge, a character who knows about a murder or knows that someone has been acting suspiciously, has her credibility wrecked by what is his name? Begins with H. Can anyone help me out? Anyway, by a character who says, Marge, there's women's intuition and then there are the facts. So this is what he says. Mr. H, I'll call him because that's all I can retrieve of his name. Marge, there's women's intuition and then there are the facts. Now, Miranda Fricker says this is an instance of testimonial injustice. Someone, due to a background identity prejudice, is robbed of their credibility. But then she goes on to say something interesting. Well, she says a lot of interesting things about this sort of case. One thing she says is that undermines her standing as a knower. To agree with that, you have to agree with a certain social picture of epistemology that says being a knower involves not only having knowledge in the sense that individualistic epistemologists have talked about it, it also involves having a social standing as a knower where that means being a credible testifier. You are damaged in your standing as a knower when you lack credibility, according to this picture, which is there in many philosophers, including Fricker and William Craig. The other thing she says that's very interesting, and I think would garner even more widespread support, is that Marge, in that moment, loses confidence in what she herself is saying. When she is trying to say there is reason to suspect this character, having her credibility attacked undermines her confidence, and then she fails to know that she knows, and then perhaps, and this is very much going to depend on your background theory of knowledge, then perhaps she fails to know herself. Maybe she does still continue to know. Maybe you don't think that in order to know, you need to know that you know. But still, there's something undermined in her own epistemic situation, not just her standing in relation to other people. And what's undermined in her own epistemic situation might be knowledge itself, or it might be the capacity to act on her knowledge, or it might be something else. I'm mentioning that just to show that if you accept this, then you are accepting that one way in which knowledge itself can follow rules of accommodation is because credibility, as in Lecture 1, follows rules of accommodation. So that's the first thing I want to talk about. That's how knowledge loss can emerge from the process of accommodation. Presupposing that she doesn't know, requires that she doesn't know. There are background conditions. She's not able to block the presupposition because of the availability of stereotypes about hysterical women and women's intuition. And so she really does lose the knowledge that she says that he says she lacks. So there's something self-fulfillingly true about that. The second way I want to talk about is there, and it's very familiar to anyone working in epistemology, and it's right there in Lewis, in Scorekeeping, in A Language Game, and then was taken up by him in his work on knowledge. Lewis argued that standard shifting happens all the time in conversations. And we talked about that last time when we were talking about how standards, the shift in standards, can enact norms within conversations, which then build up social norms more generally. Lewis had that view, understood that shifting of standards in a quite broad way. I also mentioned, by the way, that Mary-Kate McGowan has developed a theory of conversational exercitives based on this shifting of standards issue. She sees it as the constant micro-enactment of norms within conversations. Now, Lewis mentioned that Flat is something, the semantics of flat follows standards. The semantics of hexagonal follows standards. So I say, the floor is flat. And then some pedantic physicist says, oh, it's not really flat. If only you could see that under the microscope, you'd see how bumpy it really was. And I say, okay, it's not flat. But still, sort of flat enough or whatever. So there you have a standard shifting maneuver, which where at least according to some views, in one relative to one, I'm not going to get into the, which exactly are the context in which it's true, but the standard shifting relative to flat means that attributions of flatness are relative to those standards in ways that they are true in one context and not true in another. Hexagonal, France is hexagonal, same applies. Nose, according to Lewis, follows the same thing. It is sensitive to standards. Lewis famously says that epistemology is a discipline that destroys its own subject matter. Isn't that nice? He really had a way with words. When we say, do you know what time the train leaves? And I say, yes, it leaves at 6 o'clock. I'm right. The train leaves at 6 o'clock. But in the philosophy classroom, when that conversation happens, and some skeptic pipes up and says, oh, but do you really know? For all you know, you could be a brain in the vat. Or for all you know, there could be a deceiving demon. Oh, magically, following the rule of accommodation, so the skeptic presupposes that that a different standard is relevant, and hey presto, it is relevant. And relative to that standard, knowledge goes away. So that's why he says epistemology is a discipline that destroys its own subject matter. Now, I'm interested in political aspects to that. I'm just going to mention one, and I'm not going to do it justice. I might return to it if I manage in the final session. Jeremy Waldron, in his book about hate speech, The Harm in Hate Speech, a theme there that I find especially interesting is that the hate speaker destroys the assurance of justice. That is to say, the hate speaker undermines his target's assurance that the target person, the one who is at the receiving end of the hate, that this person possesses the rights that are in fact accorded to him. Now, even if the hate speaker is in a minority, according to Waldron, this assurance is undermined. I'm tempted to think of that as a bit like the skeptic. You have someone happily, at least in Waldron's picture, it's a relatively happy society where nearly everyone is egalitarian. You have someone happily enjoying their egalitarian life, enjoying the mutual respect of most citizens, and then they see Muslims and 9/11, we don't want them, get out of here, don't serve them, go back to where you came from. And that undermines the assurance that they have what justice requires. I think this is a really interesting theme. It's the general theme is that it is that justice requires a certain level of knowledge. In order to have justice, you need to have knowledge of what justice requires, at least to some level. I hope to return to that in the final section two. All I'm saying just now is that if you think that's at all plausible, then you will think that the standards for knowledge shift, that you get for free from any contextualist in epistemology, they shift following rules of accommodation. And what you get from my suggestion about the connection with Waldron is that they might shift in ways that are politically salient and that make things worse from the point of view of justice. The third thing I want to say about knowledge loss is about stakes. This has been receiving increasing attention, both in epistemology and more recently, some people have been looking at its political implications. I've put some of the relevant readings on the at the end of the handout. So some philosophers have argued that knowledge is sensitive to practical interests or stakes. Jason Stanley, Keith DeRose, John Hawthorne, at least in one incarnation. The thought is that whether you know something or whether knowledge is correctly attributed to you depends on, this time, not the standards for knowledge, but if you like, I'm tempted to say, the standards for the thing that is the topic of the knowledge. So, someone who's been at a dinner party with you says, phones you up and says, this is terrible. I've dropped my ring somewhere in your house. And the host forms the view, oh yeah, it's that rather tacky plastic ring. That's okay. I'll go and have a look, says the host. And off they go, look around the house, and they come back to the phone and they say, sorry, I can't find your plastic ring anywhere. And the guest says, plastic ring? It's not a plastic ring. It's my engagement ring. It's a diamond ring. It's got such and such. Anyway, it's got immense sentimental value and any other value that you care to name. Anyway, so imagine the situation. The host says, oh, well, I guess I don't really know. You're supposed to think, first time round, you say, the ring's not there. I know it's not there, when you think it's a plastic ring. Second time round, oh, well, I guess I don't really know it's not there. Let me go and have another look. So the thought is, your own self-attribution of knowledge depends on what is at stake in that particular case. Now, people who think that stakes matter to the attribution of knowledge, some think it matters to knowledge itself, some people think it matters to the attribution of knowledge. Whatever you think about that, one thing I find very interesting is that they all cite a heap of empirical data that says that in practice, yes, people withdraw their attributions of knowledge when the stakes get higher. So it's one of those cases where, you know, X-Fi has given us some data where people are very ready to withdraw their attributions of knowledge when there is more at stake. Are you sure there isn't a bomb in the suitcase? You know, the stakes for that are a lot higher than are you sure there isn't a pencil case in the suitcase? So the stakes issue seems relevant whether or not you're going to build it into your epistemology. Why is that politically interesting? Well, some people have suggested, and Jason Stanley is one of them, there are some others. Rachel Fraser has a little blog post about this, politicizing subject-sensitive invariantism. I just put it on the readings there. The thought is that this matters in a social context. Perhaps you can see why. One way it matters is, at least arguably, if you have a lot at stake, you are less likely to think you know something. Now consider somebody, this is Jason Stanley's suggestion, consider somebody who is wondering whether they know they are an exploited underdog in the factory. And they are wondering whether or not they should complain about it. They're wondering whether or not they should organize and get a union together and go on strike and lobby for better conditions. The cost is high for them. If things go wrong, they can be put in jail. For people who are, let's just say, the underdogs, if more is at stake, they might be less likely to know. Now, that might be compatible with something that social epistemologists like Jose Medina have wanted to argue, that there is still a case that our subordinate people have a source of knowledge that the top dogs, so to speak, don't have. Now, this is actually a very interesting area in social epistemology. It's a kind of who's more ignorant? Is it the people at the bottom or is it the people at the top? Is everybody ignorant? Anyway, I'm not going to get into that here. I think it's a very interesting question. But you can see how that if the stakes issue is relevant to whether or not you know, or relevant to whether or not you think you know, you may be less likely to act on what you know, and less likely to do something to remedy the injustice that you encounter. So that's the part where I said, in fact, it's the second one on my handout, where I said that underdogs will be less ready to self-ascribe knowledge given the higher costs of being wrong. Now, the converse of that, which hasn't had much attention, but I think is an obvious corollary of that, I do him an injustice. Jason Stanley does talk about this in his new book about propaganda. Top dogs will be more ready to self-ascribe knowledge given the lower costs of being wrong. So top dogs will be more likely to think of any particular issue where it's not a high-cost issue for them. They will be more smug in their, more complacent in their apparent knowledge. So that is an important factor when we're thinking about how unjust social structures might be perpetuated. Something I want to add to that, which I don't think has been noted by people who are interested in the stakes issue, is that the top dogs will be too ready to self-ascribe knowledge about the underdogs. So they'll be too ready to think, oh yes, I know all about them, because the them they're talking about is like the plastic ring in the story. It's the thing that isn't worth so much. Whereas I know all about them, pointing to other members of the top dog tribe, that's like whether you know about the diamond ring case. Well, I guess I'd need to find out some more about them. So think about this in practical circumstances. How much are you going to look for the survivors in the earthquake when they are members of the bottom dog tribe or the top dog tribe? That's just one area where it might happen. Now, finally, the last thing I want to say, which is, to my mind, an obvious corollary and just plain true, hasn't been had attention drawn to it, is that those who have the least at stake will speak the most. In other words, I think that there is going to be a structural problem, which means that for some topic that you care about deeply and that matters deeply to you and that is going to be tremendously costly for you to express your view about and tremendously costly if you are wrong about it, you are going to be more hesitant putting your view out there, the people who have the least stake in it are going to say the most. And I think we call this the blogosphere. I think we call this... So one place I saw this, and this is descending to mere anecdote, actually Michael Rosen sent me the link the news about a new Woody Allen film called Irrational Man. So I thought, oh my God, this is a film in which there is a philosophy professor who has an existential crisis, he solves it in a certain way which involves relationship with one of his students. Now, there are various people who might have a stake in this. Philosophers should have a stake in whether philosophy is being represented decently. In fact, it's, 1958 style philosophy. He hasn't really got up to date on that. There are a number of things that Woody Allen hadn't quite got up to date on. But anyway, the people who I thought about, who would have a stake in this, philosophers, philosophy professors, women in philosophy, students in philosophy, it's not exactly a topic that's been ignored in the philosophy profession in the last few years. all of us who have a lot of stake in this being a really interesting and important question to talk about, I couldn't find a single thing, at least in the space of 5 minutes, admittedly, on the blogosphere about these issues. But I found a zillion things which seem to be the product of, you know, inane 16-year-olds saying the first thing that popped into their head about the actors in question. Anyway, so I'm not going to get into that. There are issues about the pathologies of the internet which are much, much bigger than anything that I can get into here, but maybe I'll get to them in... this is another promissory note. Maybe I'll get to them in Lecture 5. So these were three ways connecting issues about epistemic authority, credibility especially, standards for knowledge, and stakes for knowledge. How, if you're willing to accept that these factors follow rules of accommodation, then you will see how knowledge itself could come and go following a rule of accommodation. And you will see, I hope, how that could be of interest if you're interested in social justice and social injustice. Now I want to talk about the opposite. I want to talk about how accommodation might be involved in the gain of knowledge. And this topic has received somewhat less attention in the social epistemology. It's not received zero attention, but it hasn't received so much. I'm just going to begin with... an example of someone who has commented on this. Catherine MacKinnon says, and this is quotation 3, the beliefs of the powerful become proven, she actually says proof, but I think proven would be better, in part because the world actually arranges itself to affirm what the powerful want to see. If you perceive this as a process, you might call it force, or at least pressure or socialization or what money can buy. If it is imperceptible as a process, you may consider it voluntary or consensual or free will or human nature or just the way things are. Beneath this, though, the world is not entirely the way the powerful say it is or want to believe it is. Now, one way to encapsulate that thought is that power structures enable the powerful to get knowledge because the world arranges itself to conform to what the powerful people say or believe, and there's something right about what they say and about what they believe. It's not entirely right, fortunately, but it's partly right. Here's the next quotation I want to mention, and this is from Marilyn Fry. It's from an essay called The Arrogant Eye. The arrogant perceiver coerces the objects of his perception into satisfying the conditions his perception imposes. He manipulates the environment, perception, and judgment of her whom he perceives so that her recognized options are limited and the course she chooses will be such as coheres with his purposes. How one sees another and how one expects the other to behave are in tight interdependence, and how one expects the other to behave is a large factor in determining how the other does behave. One thing that I think is important about what Fry says here is that... The word expectation has got, you know, a predictive function and also a normative function. When you think about it, any dictionary definition is going to give you both of those. I want to talk a bit more about that in just a moment. One thing I want to say, though, is that, you know, like most philosophers, I suffer the occupational hazard of being always much too abstract. So I'm going to give you an example of an arrogant eye. This is from a documentary that was broadcast, I think on Channel 4. I took it down verbatim. I recorded it and took it down verbatim. The documentary makers were Commode and Levin. Okay, so this was, I think, this was telling the story of the real Linda Lovelace, who was the star of Deep Throat in 1972. Quotation from a news commentator in 1972. Linda Lovelace is the liberated woman in her most extreme form, taking life and sex on her own terms. In this documentary, the most extraordinary thing was that they interviewed Charles Traynor, who was her husband and her pimp. Traynor was remarkably frank. I'm not going to read out everything he said. He said things like, she was pretty dumb. Everything she did, she had to be told how to do it, when to do it, why she was doing it, how to dress. It just kind of rolled along like that. I was the dominant figure, she was a submissive figure. So if it reached the point where dominance had to take over, then dominance took over. Fists are bound to fly. He was happy to say, yes, he had beaten her. He was happy to say, yes, he had told her everything to do. I schooled her on what to say. Always sound sexy. Always look cute. Wink at the camera. Wink at the interviewer. Always be titillating. You'd rather be having sex than doing anything. It was just schooling, teaching her what to say, how to say it, when to say it. It's a really remarkable set of interviews with Traynor and also with Linda Marchiano, who was the Linda Lovelace of the film, who claimed in a book called Ordeal that she had been threatened and raped in the making of the film. And what she said about this was, and on this series of interviews, I was just like a robot. I was told what to say, and I said it, because if I didn't, I was beaten brutally. Now, I said that's an example of the arrogant eye. Of course, it's way more than that. It's much more like the example of the master and the slave, because he's actually telling her what to do. You could imagine a more intermediate case where the person doesn't actually tell her what to do, but the force of the expectation is just in the way that Marilyn Fry describes. Now, I'm very interested in situations where you believe something and it turns out to be the right thing, not because your beliefs have conformed to the world in the right way, the non-accidental way, and whatever else you can add or can't add to get it to turn out to be knowledge, but rather because the world has conformed to the beliefs or conformed to the knowledge. Obviously, this is a big Kantian theme, but I won't distract myself with that. Okay. So, I'm going to remind you of some of the examples that we talked about in the previous two lectures, and I want you to think about how knowledge is involved in them. I didn't mention knowledge, apart from when I mentioned credibility. So let's think about the command case. So in Lewis we had the slave is now permitted to cross the white line and how that follows a rule of accommodation. Now I just want it to be not allowed, because I want there to be a determinate thing to say about knowledge. Something is said. The slave is not allowed to cross the white line. So I'm at 5.1 now. This requires that the force is prohibition. The slave is not allowed to cross the white line. It requires, though not as a, it requires, in some sense of requires, which I'll postpone, that the master knows that the slave is not allowed to cross the white line. We have the felicity condition clause. Certain conditions hold. The master has practical authority of the slave, etc., etc. There's no slave rebellion at the last minute. And the outcome, the felicitous outcome, is that the force is prohibition, the slave is not allowed to cross the white line. This is basically a version of what I said last time. But now, adding the knowledge part, the master knows the slave is not allowed to cross the white line. So the master's saying so makes it so, and also makes it the case that the master knows at the time of saying that the slave is not allowed to cross the white line. That's the knowledge of the rule. In the same way that a legislator knows that the legislator is enacting a law, in the usual case. Now, here's a different version. This is not in the enactment, knowledge of the enactment, it's knowledge of the future. Something is said. The slave will not cross the white line. This time, the requirement is that the illocutionary force is an assertion, or And maybe it's a predictive assertion. It's about something that's going to happen in the future. The slave will not cross the white line. And the master knows that the slave will not cross the white line. It's a future-directed bit of knowledge. And he has the future-directed bit of knowledge. Sorry, I haven't got to the part where he has it yet. That's the requirement. The felicity conditions are that the master also orders the slave. So there are all the felicity conditions that go with the order. And when all of that is in place, the force gets to be predictive assertion, but it also gets to be knowledge. The master knows that the slave will not cross the white line. Why is it knowledge? Well, I should now wave at you a nice whole theory of epistemology that is going to prove this. Nevertheless, I will just suggest to you that pretty much every theory of knowledge will give you that result, that the master knows the slave will not cross the white line, unless you're going to suddenly be... Well, actually, I'm not going to give any caveats at all. Here's my bet is that pretty much every theory of epistemology, any theory of knowledge is going to give you the result that the master knows that the slave will cross the white line. It's not an accident that the belief is true. Thinking of Unger on non-accidentality, it's the belief is safe. It's the result of a reliable connection. Whatever you want to throw at it, my hunch is, maybe I'll just put it as a hunch, and if you prove me wrong, I will definitely have learned something. There's more than one thing I'm going to learn, by the way. But anyway, let me just okay. So. There we had knowledge and command. We had knowledge and prediction backed up by command. Now, there are many cases that fall short of a command. And when we were talking about norms last week, we looked at lots of the really interesting ones. For instance, we looked at generics. Now, one thing I didn't say about generics that is of huge importance if we're interested in the accommodation of generics in conversations is that generics can be involved, like many other speech acts, in certain kinds of social looping effects. Some social scientists call it social looping. Obviously, this connects with wider issues about social construction. So let's take one of the generics we looked at last time that was discussed by Sarah Jane Leslie, who I realize I just forgot to put in the readings, but you've got it from last time. Men take charge, women are gentle and accommodating. It's a generic, it's unquantified. Being a generic, it's not quite clear whether it's it's probably not a striking property generic. It might be, is it a statistical generic? Is it a characteristic generic, sort of invoking the nature or essence of women? Is it an ideal characteristic generic where it's not really a description at all, it's a prescription disguised as a description. It's saying this is what, even if you don't produce for me a single man taking charge or a single gentle and accommodating woman, I will still affirm that men take charge and women are gentle and accommodating because that is what they should be. So we talked last time about the ambiguity of generics and why that is important for considering what sort of speech act they are. Let's suppose that said, what's required, as I said last time, maybe it's that the force is assertion, maybe there's a presupposed verdictive or directive, depending on how we unpack it, or maybe we're unpacking it in all of those mushy ways at once. And also, the speaker is supposed to know it. They're supposed to know the truth of men take charge, etc. Now, so I'm adding the... Basically, what I'm doing is adding the knowledge thing to what we talked about last time. So, there are all the felicity conditions that we talked about last time. Nobody's going to block it by saying, well, what do you really mean? Do you mean all of them? Do you mean some of them? Do you mean they ought to? Do you mean they are? No one's going to get in and clarify it, which basically is going to block some of the mushiness of it all. The outcome, if these felicity conditions are in place, including, crucially, the felicity condition that makes it no accident that people do what is expected of them. Okay, so that was put very graphically by Marilyn Fry in a sort of two-person situation, one person who is subjugated to one other person. But in a social context, of course, it's going to be much more diffuse than that. You will not have just one person subjugated to another. You will have groups of people in hierarchies. So, and it's no accident that people will tend to do what's expected, and so will tend to do what the generics say they're expected to do. Expected can have its predictive meaning, or it might have its normative meaning. So that's one of the mechanisms for social looping. Now, in this case, we have not got an enactment that is straight away known because the enactor is performing the enactment, like the master saying, slave, you are not permitted to cross the white line. It's much more diffuse than that. Nevertheless, you have somebody uttering a generic statement. Why are they uttering it? Here's the other complication. They might be uttering it because they think they have inductive evidence for it already. That is a whole side to it that I haven't got time to talk about this minute. Insofar as what they're saying is one of the speech acts that is helping make that very speech act true through a context where it is no accident that people are conforming to that speech act, what I want to suggest is the utterer of that generic statement has knowledge of the truth of what they are saying. They have knowledge of it on some disambiguation or other. They might have knowledge of it as a statistical generalization, if that's what it turns out to be. They obviously do not have knowledge of it as a normative statement, because it's false. They obviously do not have knowledge of it as a statement about the nature of men and women, because that's a modal statement that is also false. Nevertheless, they might have knowledge of it as a statistical one, and that is going to matter. Now, I'm nearly out of time, and that's fine, because I've only got two more things to say. The first thing to say is that I hope you've noticed that these have a very anomalous direction of fit. So the direction of fit is, of course, a topic that Elizabeth Anscombe put on the philosophical agenda. Perhaps, I'm not saying she was the first, I've come across it in many other, well, actually, it's all there in Plato, isn't it? There we go, footnotes too. It's all there in the Euthyphro problem, that's a direction of fit issue. It's there in Maimonides in the topic of maker's knowledge. But there's a lot of great things I could say about Anscombe, but I'm running out of time. That one thing I do want to say about Anscombe is just this very nice example, number 6 on the handout. When a doctor says to a patient in the presence of a nurse, "Nurse will take you to the operating theater," this may function both as an expression of his intention and as an order, as well as being information to the patient. Isn't that nice? Isn't that a lovely example? It's a lovely example because it's an example of one utterance that is many illocutionary speech acts at once. What I want to add to that is that the doctor knows that the patient will be taken to the theatre. So the doctor, and this is part of Anscombe's thought, the doctor has a certain kind of... What the doctor has... That sort of knowledge of what's going to happen is comparable in certain ways to our knowledge of our own actions. It's a book about intention, after all. And Velleman has taken this up in his work on intention to say that knowing what I will do is my way of making it the case that I will do something. So I'm not doing justice to Velleman here, but the basic thought is practical knowledge has this direction of fit that is the direction of fit of maker's knowledge of the sort that theologians talked about and still do talk about. The sort of knowledge that a creator has of their creature. In general, it has an anomalous direction of fit. Instead of the belief coming to fit the world is coming to fit the belief. Some people have wondered whether that stops it being knowledge. Lloyd Humberstone has suggested that stops it being knowledge. David Lewis, in a paper about veridical hallucination, says that it's not going to count as knowledge if the direction of fit is wrong in the case of perception. But when we're thinking about these other cases, I can see no reason for denying the title of knowledge to it. And so I want to say it is knowledge, even though it's got the wrong, even though it's got an unusual direction of fit, the sort that normally goes with practical knowledge. Now, the last thing I want to do is say something very brief about why this matters. It matters because, okay, I've talked about knowledge loss and knowledge gain. Knowledge loss and knowledge gain both matter if we're interested in how injustice is created and masked through the process of accommodation. So, knowledge loss is itself part of injustice. It's unfair when you don't get to know something because you don't have credibility and your confidence in what you know gets undermined. That's the theme in Fricker. That's just one instance on the knowledge loss side. All of the others are obviously involve injustices. And it also masks injustice because it means that when injustice is there, you don't get evidence of it because the people who could testify about it don't have credibility. So it not only constitutes injustice, it also masks injustice. Now, that is a big theme in social epistemology. What's less of a theme is the second thing I talked about, gains in knowledge. Both constitute and mask injustice. They constitute injustice because they are an aspect of injustice. When the master says to the slave, "You're forbidden," and the master knows that, the knowledge is intrinsic to the subordination. I need to say way more about that, but I'll leave it at that for the constitution claim. And obviously it masks injustice. Why does it mask injustice? Think about the generic case. When people conform to the generic stereotype that has been uttered, that, of course, is itself an injustice because they shouldn't be consigned to those roles. But also it masks the injustice because it provides further inductive evidence for the thing that was said in the first place. So possible counter-evidence is hidden from view. So the accommodation of knowledge matters both in its loss and its gain, and it matters because it constitutes injustice and it masks injustice. And unless we reveal it, we can't do anything about it. Thank you.